from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. He had fast fists, a long reach, and a silver tongue.
I'm handsome, I'm fast, I'm pretty, and can't possibly be beat.
From around the world, tributes have poured in for Muhammad Ali. He died Friday at 74, the three-time world boxing champ. Vietnam War dissenter, man of faith, a voice for social justice that will be remembered by the title he bestowed upon himself, the greatest. Born Cassius Clay in Louisville, at 22, he converted to Islam and changed his name to Muhammad Ali. He rejected his government's call to service in Vietnam and paid dearly for it. Over the years, Ali was a champion in and outside of the ring. He knocked out boxing's best and stood for black Americans against a racist status quo. And he bravely fought against Parkinson's disease. This hour on Point, we open our hearts and minds to the whole Muhammad Ali one last time. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How will you remember Muhammad Ali as a boxer, civil rights champion, a little of both? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's listen back. We never want to be without somehow this voice. Here he was, still Cassius Clay at age 18.
I'm not only a fighter, I'm a poet, I'm a prophet. I'm the resurrector. I'm the savior of the boxing world. If it wasn't for me, the game would be dead.
Here, before fights, again, he would spout boastful poems for what was perhaps his most famous fight in 1971 against Joe Frazier. He spouted this gem.
Joe's gonna come out smoking, and I ain't gonna be joking. I'll be pecking and a-poking, pouring water on his smoking. Then this might shock and amaze you, but I will destroy Joe Frazier.
But it wasn't all about poetry. Banned from boxing in 1967 after refusing to serve in Vietnam, he went on a college campus speaking tour to help pay his bills. This is what he told a crowd of mostly white students who thought he should go fight in Vietnam.
You my enemy. My name is a white people, not Viet Cong or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
We're going to spend this hour remembering Muhammad Ali, and we want to hear from you. This was a man about whom everybody has an opinion, and now that he's gone, we want to hear from you. Ishmael Reed joins us. From Oakland, California, novelist, poet, essayist, playwright, renowned cultural thinker, professor emeritus at UC Berkeley, author of The Complete Muhammad Ali. His op-ed piece in the New York Times over the weekend, Muhammad Ali Worshipped, Misunderstood, Exploited. Ishmael Reed, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
And with us from Carlock, Illinois, David Kindred, longtime sports writer. He first met Ali in 1974, maybe earlier, at the Louisville Courier as a Cub reporter there, was ringside at 17 of Muhammad Ali's fights, including 10 championship bouts. He's author of a terrific book about Ali's friendship with sportscaster Howard Cosell, titled Sound and Fury, Two Powerful Lives, One Fateful Friendship. David Kindred in Carlock, Illinois, right in my old hometown territory. Welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Tom.
Can you take us back? Well, let's start this way, maybe. You've both been listening over this weekend to all the remembrances of Muhammad Ali. And I wonder, David, as you listen and think about what you're hearing, what's missing?
There's not much missing. Ali touched everybody. I mean, he touched people figuratively and literally. He was the most accessible of celebrities, the most accessible of athletes. He wanted people around him. He wanted people to touch him. He wanted to touch them. It was an amazing thing to be witness to. I first met him in 1966, by the way, exactly 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a joy ride from the start.
Entertainer, comic, preacher, politician. You remember Coretta Clay, his father's sister, calling him the Alpha and Omega. You say once you had been in his presence, he never left you. What do you mean?
I mean, that's why we're talking about him now. I mean, he was magnetic. He was, someone compared him to, you know, this huge magnet that drew filings to him, filings mm-hmm. being the people. There was that. But he was unique. I mean, I've never imagined, and no one can imagine, a person like him, a person who comes with so many facets and represents so much in so many different ways, from the minute to the gigantic. It was an amazing experience. As you've seen over this weekend, I mean, I just had a call from a Japanese TV crew that wants to come to, you know, godforsaken Carlock, Illinois, to talk to me.
Hey, now.
You know, it's ridiculous.
From Japan, you say, to call him unique is to praise him faintly, like saying Everest is a hill. Ishmael Reed, as you listen to the praise just roll in from all directions from Muhammad Ali and the memories, what's on your mind?
Well, in my book, I tried to examine some of the points of view that have been left out, from black nationalists to a Filipino-American journalist, Emil Guillermo, who talked about the thrill of Manila, to Fred Ho, the only Chinese-American who belonged to the Nation of Islam. And some of the voices that I recorded would dispute this glorification of Muhammad Ali at this point. Jill Nelson, for example, the novelist, spoke for a lot of the people I interviewed, who said that the mainstream loves Ali now because he was shut down, because he was not the boastful, arrogant person who criticized racism in American society. So they would say that a lot of this mourning is probably crocodile tears. Now, here's a man who fought the last two fights experiencing brain damage, according to Angelo Dundee. Matter of fact, his exit was so pitiful. Emmanuel Stewart, whom I interviewed in Las Vegas, said that when he fought Trevor Burbick, the camera crew, ABC I think it was, wanted to show him going do an exhibition with Tommy Hearns. And Tommy Hearns refused because he was in such bad shape. This man was left broke with brain damage. Nobody came to his aid. He had to make a living by showing up at fights for $1,000. And yet, we hear all this praise. There was only one person who tried to rescue him, and that was his current wife, Yolanda.
Here's a little sound of Muhammad Ali. This is 1964, after the Sonny Liston fight, when he announced he'd converted to the Nation of Islam. And then later, 1971, he gave this TV interview and was asked about his religion.
And I'm going to look at two or three white people who are trying to do right and don't see the other million trying to kill me. I'm not that big of a fool. And I'm not going to deny it. I believe everything he teach. And if the white people of the country are not the devil, then they should prove they're not the devil.
Muhammad Ali, 1971. Dave Kindred, Parkinson's took from him that expressiveness later in his life. If he'd been able to speak, do you think that was still what was on his mind, in his heart?
I don't think so. I think that, first of all, the Parkinson's, I think, is secondary to brain damage. You know, we talk a lot these days about CTE and football players.
Yep.
Muhammad Ali took a million blows to the head. As Cassius Clay, you couldn't hit him. As Muhammad Ali, he invited you to hit him. You know, the Parkinson's is secondary. The original diagnosis was Parkinson's syndrome, meaning he had the symptoms but not the disease, secondary to pugilistic syndrome, meaning caused by getting hit in the head a million times. So boxing ruined him. I would abolish boxing if I could, but boxing gave us him also. You know, I think his life can be divided three ways. The Muhammad Ali that I knew from 66 on was a sweetheart. All the time. You know, the Nation of Islam, 10 years there during Elijah Muhammad's life, I've always thought was not the Ali that I saw, not the Ali that most people knew.
That's a long time. That's still the man.
Boy, can't get a word in there.
Yes, please, Ishmael Reed, you certainly can. Please do.
You know, without the Nation of Islam, that's typical of Caucasian sports writers. Without the Nation of Islam, nobody would ever have heard of Muhammad Ali. All the speeches that you recorded recently,
that we just played here, yep.
Was parroting Muhammad Speaks editorials and message to the black man. The Nation of Islam gave him consciousness. No matter how you felt about the way he expressed that consciousness. Now, these people organized a business that brought in $70 million a year. He yeah, there were criminal elements in the Nation of Islam, but there were also physicists, there were scientists. As a matter of fact, the late Lonnie X was a scientist who was a NASA scientist at NASA. Martin Wyatt, the ABC news reporter, belonged to the Nation of Islam. Azim Muhammad was a Pulitzer Prize winner. Elijah Muhammad's grandson is now the head of the Schoenberg Library. So I think the sports writers have which is a Jim Crow fraternity, even worse than, I mean, the worst of the journalists, which is something to say. I think the source writers' commentary on Muhammad Ali is flawed, fundamentally flawed, because they will not admit the influence that the Nation of Islam had on Muhammad Ali.
Well, can't you hear it in almost all his speeches from that time, Ishmael Reed? I mean, as you say, when he would come off with these enormous riffs, you know there's some teaching and learning that's gone on behind that, and a lot of it sounded like Nation of Islam influence to me.
Absolutely, but the sports writers won't give them credit.
Well, David Kindred, you're not saying that Ali didn't know what he was talking about for 10-plus years.
No, I believe that Ali completely believed that. I believe that he preached it better than anyone else. I believe that he gave the Nation of Islam a presence that it had not had, that it had been denied. You know, there's no doubt that, I mean, when he first announced it, admitted or said that he was a member of the Nation of Islam, it was a scary thing in the city of Louisville. You know, the newspaper in Louisville, I worked there from 65 to 77. Until 1971, they were still referring to him as Cassius Clay.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the greatest Muhammad Ali, boxer, rebel, fighter, poet, champion of civil rights, of black pride, of human dignity, dead on Friday at 74. You can join us this hour. How will you remember Muhammad Ali? How did you see him as a boxer, as a fighter in the bigger arena of life? Do you remember when Muhammad Ali directly challenged American norms, the American status quo? How did he pull that off so compellingly? Black listeners in particular, what did this man mean to you? What did he stand for? What did he show? Did white Americans understand how revolutionary he really was? Dave Kindred is with us, sports writer and author. He covered 17 of Muhammad Ali's fights, including 10 for the heavyweight championship. Met Ali in 1964 as a cub reporter for the Louisville Courier, author of Sound and Fury. Ishmael Reed is with us as well from Oakland, California, novelist, poet, essayist, playwright, Professor Emeritus at UC Berkeley, author of The Complete Muhammad Ali. His big essay in the Times over the weekend was Muhammad Ali Worshipped, Misunderstood, Exploited. We'll look more at that. Here was Ali himself, still Cassius Clay, at this moment, 1964. He battled heavyweight champ Sonny Liston in Miami after six rounds. Liston was done, didn't come out for the seventh, and Clay then was the new heavyweight champ. After this fight, he announced his conversion to the Nation of Islam.
Hold it. I'm hurting. Hold it. You're not that pretty. I'm a bad man. Wait. I shook up the world.
The next day, he announced that he was joining the Nation of Islam. Malcolm X saw him as a cultural force, could inspire people around the world. Here's Malcolm X saying Americans misunderstood him, that he was an ideal role model for black youths. This is Malcolm X in a 1964 television interview.
Cassius is in a better position than anyone else to restore the a sense of racial pride to not only our people in this country, but all over the world. And he is trying his best to live a clean life and project a clean image. But despite this, you find the press is constantly trying to paint him as something other than what he actually is. He doesn't smoke. He doesn't drink. In fact, if he was white, they would be referring to him as the all-American boy.
Dave Kindred, put us ringside at your earliest times covering him for the Louisville Courier. You've known him, I guess, longer than any of us. What was it like? What was he like?
My first fight that I saw in person was the Quarry fight when he came back from the 3.5 years of exile that took away the best 3 years of any professional athlete's life.
Just because he refused to be drafted for the Vietnam War.
Yes, the boxing commissions unfairly, unjustly stripped him of the championship, allowed him no work, even revoked. His passport was revoked when he was arrested. You know, he couldn't leave the country. He couldn't work.
Yep.
He became, I think that's the significant moments of his life that made him why we're talking about him now, because the most famous man on the planet stood up to the most powerful government in the world because he thought that he was right, and history did move to his side on all that.
How did he become a boxer in the first place?
Well, the legend is that his bicycle was stolen at a flea market sale in Louisville. He went to the nearest policeman and reported that and said that if he ever found whoever the thief was, he was going to beat him up. The policeman, a man named Joe Martin, said, well, if you're going to do that, you should learn to fight first. Martin happened to be a fight instructor in a park kind of recreation department in Louisville and took him in as a fighter. And there was also a fight trainer in Louisville named Fred Stoner, who never gets the credit that he fully deserves, perhaps because he was an African-American. But Stoner was instrumental in the creation of Ali also.
He went to the Olympics. He won. He got the backing of a group of Louisville millionaires, as I understand it. Who were they, and what were they hoping for, and did they get it from this young man?
It was called the Louisville Group. There were 11 of them, and they were, you know, white paternalists of the time who... He had actually worked for one of those men named William Reynolds, a man in the Reynolds Aluminum, as aluminum tycoon. And they thought that they, and as one of your voices there a minute ago said, Malcolm X called him the All-American Boy. And that's the way those 11 men saw him.
Well, Malcolm X said he would be if he weren't black. They looked through that. They saw him as an investment opportunity as well, I guess.
Yes, they did, exactly. You know, and they I think, believe they had his best interest at heart, but it was a very paternal, almost plantation kind of mentality in Louisville about the young Cassius Clay.
Ishmael Reed, how did he then, Cassius Clay, come into contact with the Nation of Islam and make that journey? How did it happen that we wouldn't learn about it until the day after the famous Sonny Liston fight?
Abdul Rahman, or Sam X, as he was known at the time, recruited Muhammad Ali into the Nation of Islam. He was out selling Muhammad Speaks, and Muhammad Ali approached him and informed him that he had been reading Muhammad Speaks. He got to know him and brought him into the Nation, and though a number of writers attribute that expression, no Vietnamese ever called me N-word or whatever they say nowadays.
Mm.
It was Sam X who instructed him and gave him that phrase. The scene was in Florida. The women were cooking for them, and the reporters were outside, and Ali came and asked Abdul Rahman what to tell him. He said, tell him no Vietnamese ever called you the N-word. Now, you have to back up. It's very rare that I find sports writers talking about what led Ali to this decision. His mentor was Elijah Muhammad. It's almost like a father to him. Elijah Muhammad refused to fight in World War II, the good war.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there was a lot of protests against the Vietnam War, but World War II is supposed to be the greatest generation,
right.
Brokaw says. Elijah Muhammad went around the country making pro-Japanese speeches because he refused to fight what he called the Asiatic black man. The Asiatic black man, which leads right to Ali refusing to fight the Vietnamese. He was arrested for sedition. They couldn't get him on sedition, so they got him on draft dodging. I think he was 44 years old at the time. So Rahman informed Ali of that precedent. Now, we talked about Malcolm X, and I disagree with Dave. I think that Malcolm X was the greatest spokesperson for the Nation of Islam before he abandoned it. Ali followed Elijah Muhammad. Even when it came to his friend Malcolm X, he turned his back on Malcolm X. He ridiculed him when he saw him in Africa as a holy man. Yet, Muhammad Ali had a spiritual enlightenment when he left the Nation of Islam and followed Wallace D. Muhammad into Orthodox Islam and became a holy man himself. So I think a lot of these things are glossed over. There's also a background in the history to Muhammad Ali, and I never hear that mentioned by most of the people who wrote over 100 books about the champion.
His father
One more thing.
Yes, sir.
I saw Muhammad Ali fight Doug Jones at Madison Square Garden, early 60s. He lost the fight. Doug Jones never recovered from that. But because he was so good at marketing, something he learned from Gorgeous George, we can go into that, Gorgeous George, the wrestler. I'm sure Dave remembers Gorgeous George, the flamboyant wrestler.
Yep.
He was so good at marketing, he was so telegenic, that they gave him that fight. Sonny Liston had to fight everybody on the way up. Dave knows that.
I completely believe that, yes.
He had to bust a lot of people before he got a championship.
Yep.
And when he retired on the stool, everybody made fun of Sonny Liston, but he did have an actual shoulder injury. He had bursitis of the shoulder, and doctors verified that.
I want to listen for just a moment to that fight. This is the famous fight where February 25th, 1964, champion, the heavyweight champ of the world, Sonny Liston, promised to take out this 22-year-old challenger, then Cassius Clay, in two rounds. But Clay then kept slipping past Liston's punches, kept stinging him with that long left jab. And by the end, just of just the first round, things were not looking so good for Sonny Liston. A little sound from that time.
Sonny seems to be trying to slip those left leads. Can't do it too successfully because the challenger is jabbing all over, body, head, and right hand. The best punch in the fight so far. We're down to the closing second of this first round, and the long left lead is making the difference so far by Mr. Clay.
February 25th, 1964. By the end of that boxing match, Cassius Clay would be heavyweight champ of the world and soon would be Muhammad Ali. Lots of callers for the two of you. Ishmael Reed, Dave Kindred. Lucius is calling from Franklin, Tennessee. Lucius, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that Muhammad Ali that inspires me about him was his strong beliefs and convictions. But my question to one of your guests is, at the height of this man's career, why did the Army or whoever the armed forces were want to draft him into the Vietnam War at the height of his career, taking 3 years of this man's life? I know it was a conspiracy or that he was a powerful black man going against an establishment. I know why would his name come up to be drafted into the Vietnam War and take away some of the prime boxing area of his life?
Lucius, I hear you loud and clear. On the one hand, a lot of people were being drafted, lots of people. On the other hand, we know, you look back at famous Americans over time, and many of them found ways to serve in different ways or not to be in the military. I'll put that to both my guests. Dave Kindred, first to you. What was this politically motivated? His draft status was changed.
I don't think so. I think that he was, 24 years old, 25 years old. He was prime material to be drafted. The first time that he was drafted, he didn't qualify on the aptitude test, I believe. And then they lowered the requirements on aptitude and then redrafted him. I don't think there was any conspiracy to draft, this famous guy. I've never heard that, but I know that he was drafted twice.
Ishmael Reed, what your thoughts on the question?
Yeah, he felt that he was unfairly treated. And I think at the time, I remember there was like a mass hysteria when they didn't draft him, because they felt that he was beating up people in the ring, and why shouldn't he go to Vietnam? So there was a lot of public movement to have him drafted. That's how he felt. But finally,
I mean, Elvis Presley served in the military. Frank Sinatra served in the military. You know, didn't Joe DiMaggio serve in the military?
Well, they called Jack Dempsey a draft dodger.
Yes,
Jack Dempsey was considered the greatest heavyweight champion of all time by some, and he was considered a draft dodger. So I think that it might have been politically motivated. We just don't put anything past them. You know, the FBI really were responsible for fracturing the relationship between Malcolm X and Muhammad Ali, and also Elijah Muhammad. That's all in a book called Race Matters about the FBI spying on these people. So we just get a little, I guess, justifiable paranoia.
That's a great point there, Ishmael, the whole FBI thing, because right. I believe that, yeah, the great irony, of course, is that once Ali had left the mentorship of Malcolm X, Malcolm X made the trip to Mecca. Malcolm X converted or at least moved to Orthodox Islam, and that was Ali's eventual route, too. So eventually they became the same person, again, as they had been once.
Let me go to Callie in Atlanta, Georgia. Callie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I don't really have a question. I just called because you were asking people to reflect and remember about
Yes, please.
Muhammad Ali.
Yeah.
He was one of my patients. I was one of his physical therapists when he was at Emory University Hospital here in Atlanta. And
how long ago, Kelly?
What's that?
How long ago are we talking about here?
I'm thinking about 8 years ago.
Okay.
I'm not positive, but I think everybody remembers how impaired his mobility was, and
yeah.
His even facial expressions were limited. But
yeah.
Even so, he came across as a man with a great sense of humor and with an incredibly generous spirit. I remember one time walking down the hall with him, and he's using a walker and struggling with the pace, and several ambulance drivers came past. One of them was a young black man, and when Muhammad Ali saw him, he straightened up, looked forward, let go of his walker, and started punching in the air.
Wow.
And this young man's jaw dropped open, and I sort of nodded to him, and then back at the nurse's station, he goes, "I can't believe I just saw Muhammad Ali." And I said, "You know, his wife is in the room with him, and he likes to give autographs. I think it was his way of, you know, giving back to the community."
Yes.
And
yeah.
So I said, "You want to go back to the room and ask his wife, and I think you could get his autograph." He goes, "Really, really?" And so he went back and got Muhammad Ali's autograph and came back with, just totally amazed. And that's the kind of guy Muhammad Ali was. He was very generous with his time, and obviously everybody remembers that he's a hugely brave man, but that was, you might think of him being brave in the ring, but he was brave facing the adversity that he faced in his later years, and he was a real hero, that's all.
Kelly in Atlanta, we got it, and I'm so glad for your call. I mean, I had the pleasure of spending some time with Muhammad Ali in the late 70s. He was in Hong Kong when the Vietnamese refugees were coming in, visiting those camps, maybe as some kind of UN ambassador, and going from camp to camp in the limo there, I think with his wife, Veronica. And to be in his presence, to sit in that car and with him is just, his humor was so high, Dave Kindred. His humor was just unbelievable, but at the same time, he was always looking out politically, right alongside that humor.
True. I mean, he's a complete entertainer, you know, that always had a purpose. He moved with confidence and purpose and always with great joy. That's why I say that once you're in his presence, you never forgot it.
Here he was. Talk about why he was drafted. If they thought that would shut him up, it certainly did not. Ishmael Reed talks about where his teaching came from. He was convicted of draft evasion. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison, but fined $10,000, banned from boxing for 3 years was the real import of it. Here's a TV interview with Muhammad Ali, 1967. He's defending his decision.
My conscience won't let me go shoot my brother or some darker people or some poor hungry people in the mud for big, powerful America and shoot them for what? They never called me nigger. They never lynched me. They didn't put no dogs on me. They didn't rob me of my nationality, rape and kill my mother and father. What, I'm going to shoot them for what?
Ishmael Reed, when you hear him just off the cuff there with those remarks, what are you thinking?
Well, he made a lot of other kind of remarks, like interracial couples ought to be murdered in a, you know, Playboy interview. Made some terrible statements about Africa. But I think he matured after a while. For example, in the 60s, he said that if he had any white ancestry, it must have been because a slave master raped one of his ancestors. His ancestor was a guy named Abraham Brady, came here from Ireland broke. He finally owned up to that, and the last year or so, he went to Ireland and met all the Gradys. Now, he claimed his ancestry. I think his ancestry, just like Barack Obama's Irish ancestry, came here during the potato famine. He went to Ireland and was greeted by 50,000 people. That didn't make the American newspapers. I had to read that in the Irish Times because, you know, there's a prohibition to mention anything about race mixing over here, although the first 200 years of American history are spent like great race mixing. I'm part of that heritage.
Ishmael Reed, stand by, please. You have to take a short break. Dave Kindred, certainly looks like America's got a lot of mixing going on right now. We're talking about Muhammad Ali. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
This On Point podcast and following message are brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the future of finance to the disruptive potential of artificial intelligence, tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the greatest, Muhammad Ali, boxer, rebel, fighter, poet, champion of civil rights, of black pride, human dignity. Ishmael Reed is with us. He's author of The Complete Muhammad Ali, and the essay in the Times over the weekend, Muhammad Ali, Worshipped, Misunderstood, Exploited. Dave Kindred is with us, sports writer, author. He's covered 17 of Muhammad Ali's fights, including 10 for the heavyweight championship. Came up out of the Louisville Courier, where, of course, in Louisville is where Muhammad Ali, as Cassius Clay, grew up. He's author of Sound and Fury, Two Powerful Lives, One Fateful Friendship, about Ali's friendship with broadcaster Howard Cosell. You can join us this hour. How do you, will you remember Muhammad Ali? What will he mean to you? And how did Ali do it? How did he win in the ring, win so many hearts, challenge, and win over, ultimately, both? It wasn't all wins. It was March 1973. Ali lost against a younger Kenny Norton in a split decision late in the 12th round. Norton delivered a punch that broke Ali's jaw.
Good right bite, but that right hurt Muhammad Ali. That right hurt Ali. It got in there and there's blood in Ali's mouth, too. Norton is all over. Norton is the one with the fight left in him.
And then, of course, the unforgettable so-called rumble in the jungle in Kinshasa, Zaire, now Congo, October 1974, just the next year. End of the eighth, the two titans completely exhausted. Foreman, George Foreman, throwing slow, soft punches. Ali on the ropes. Ali found the strength to come off those ropes, finish the epic battle with a full-on right punch straight into Foreman's face. Foreman's knees buckled.
30 seconds left in round eight. Very even fight. Ali, a sneaky right hand. Another sneaky right hand. This time he works over the shoulder of Foreman.
His views on race, Muhammad Ali, yes, they could be tough. And he talked about, you know, tigers running with tigers and lions with lions, each with their own. Here he was with Michael Parkinson on the BBC in 1971, talking about views on race and race mixing.
No woman on this whole earth, not even a black woman in Muslim countries, can please me and cook for me and socialize and talk to me like my American black woman. No woman, at last is a white woman, can really identify with me and my feelings and the way I act and the way I talk. It's just nature. You can do what you want, but it's nature to want to be with your own.
On Friday, many will speak at his memorial service in Louisville, among them former President Bill Clinton. He talked in Inglewood, California on Saturday about remembering Muhammad Ali lighting the torch during the 1996 Atlanta Olympics when he was suffering from Parkinson's.
Once the most graceful, powerful athlete in the world with his hands shaking, holding on, that he did his job. And to the very end, he was actually astonishingly good-humored about the burden of his later years. So by the time he died, who he was as a person was greater than his legend.
Lots of callers from my guests, David Kindred and Ishmael Reed. Muwakil in Springfield, Massachusetts. Thank you for calling, Muwakil. You're on the air.
Yes. In Islam, it is said that if a practicing Muslim dies during the month of Ramadan, which we're just entering, mm-hmm. and if he passes away on a Friday, he goes straight to heaven. And I think those words will speak for itself for Muhammad Ali. Hmm. We were from the same community. But what I remember him great is his many attributes, his many assets. And one factor, one is that it was in Atlanta. It was back in the late 70s. I think it was around 79. It was Mayor Jackson of Atlanta had this fundraiser. And for the Boys and Girls Club in Atlanta, it was called the Rumble in Atlanta. And Mamie Jackson was a kind of, you know, stout kind of big guy,
yeah,
which was all good at that Muhammad Ali said, and it was a fight, and Muhammad Ali,
like a staged fight, you mean a fun fight for a fundraiser?
Yeah, he took a punch from Ali, and then Ali fell on the canvas, and Maynard Jackson raised up his hands. I'm the greatest. I'm the greatest. I'm the greatest. The whole crowd passed out in pandemonium. It was the greatest. It was the greatest event I ever saw in my life. I wanted to thank you very much.
A kind of a just for fun fight between a politician and Muhammad Ali. Mawakil, I appreciate your call a lot. One more, if we may. Suzanne in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Suzanne, you're on.
Hi. One thing I'll always remember and be proud of was the very strong relationship between Muhammad Ali and Howard Cosell, as unlikely a pair as you might ever find. I think it showed a depth of character that he could take this other somewhat famous pop figure and somewhat outcast and relate to him and be so close with him his whole life. I mean, I wish I could hear what Howard Cosell would say these days about Muhammad Ali. And I think he made a lot of people... I was a young Jewish high school student as Muhammad Ali became famous, and I was very proud of that relationship. It helped a lot of people understand conscientious objection and taking a different stance in the Vietnam War, and I thought that it was just a delight to see the two of them together.
Suzanne, I appreciate your call. Dave Kindred, what about that relationship? You've written about it a lot in Sound and Fury, your book. Howard Cosell really was on Ali's side during those years when he was banned from boxing. Helped keep him in the limelight and maybe help keep a living coming.
I think that's the main thing that he did for him. He gave him a place to speak when much of America wanted nothing to do with Ali. Cosell, then a star at ABC television, gave him a platform many times, and while not overtly defending Ali's position on anything, Cosell defended Ali's right to have those positions. It was a fine line that he walked all the time, but you know, the full credit is that he gave him a way to be on national television to say what he needed to say.
We've got lots of comments online. Tom Nader writes, Ali repeatedly stuck it to ignorant bigots in America, and for that, he's a true hero, period. Martin writes, Ishmael, he says, Ali betrayed Malcolm X. He was naive and clueless to the truth about the Nation of Islam. He was a pawn. You've studied this. What do you say, Ishmael?
I think he's right. I think that Muhammad Ali actually parroted a lot of the policies of the Nation of Islam. I interviewed Marvin X, who was a black nationalist poet. He said he was hired to go interview Muhammad Ali in Chicago. Eldridge Cleaver was supposed to do it, but for some reason he didn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
He said that he was interviewing Muhammad Ali when Honorable Elijah Muhammad called him in. And when he emerged from the room, Muhammad Ali said the messenger didn't want him to do an interview, and he gave Marvin X $100. Now, let me talk a little bit about this white man is the devil stuff. I was surprised to learn from some of the people with Elijah Muhammad in the mansion that he had white people regularly as dinner guests, and that one of his best friends was this guy named Cup, who used to have a show in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked one of the members of the Nation why there was this public policy about the Yaqub's mad scientists creating white people, which he abandoned in 1974.
But that was Muhammad Elijah's line for a long time.
Yeah, but he said, well, that they couldn't teach the masses of people the Quran, so they had to do comic book stuff, like mad scientists and flying saucers and all this kind of thing. Now, so when Wallace Muhammad took over, he said, disregard all the stuff in my father's teachings that you cannot find in the Quran, and keep those things that are in the Quran. So that's when the transformation of Muhammad Ali took place under the leadership of Wallace Muhammad. He tried to clean up the temples, get rid of the criminal elements, and he became more of a humanist after that. So it's interesting for me to know that the man who dismissed Malcolm X, whom he betrayed as a holy man, eventually became a holy man himself and was celebrated by people, members of religions all over the world, including Buddhists. Now, Howard Cosell, I interviewed, Dave, you know Gene Kilroy, right?
Yes.
Yeah, Gene Kilroy, who was the one who said that instead of spending all this money on, you know, different camps, he should get Deer Lake. He should buy one camp to train in. Gene Kilroy said that he and Howard Cosell were not that close, that he was never invited into their home, and that Howard Cosell actually put down Muhammad Ali in a book about Sugar Ray Leonard. You know, after Ali, Howard Cosell began to embrace Sugar Ray Leonard.
What about that relationship, Dave?
It was not a let's go to dinner together, let's go on vacation together. They were never, that was one of, you know, no, they were not friends in the sense of social friends. They were friends, you know, convenient, friends of convenience. It was a business partnership. They both knew that they could profit from it. But I don't believe Gene when he says, I didn't read that in Cosell's book. Cosell was loyal to Ali from the end, taped a thing even when Cosell himself was dying in 92, I believe, when Muhammad was 50 years old, taped a thing winding up by saying that you are free to be who you want to be, I love you. And I believe that. I believe that was the real Cosell speaking to the real Muhammad Ali.
Linda in Lexington, Kentucky. Thank you for calling, Linda. You're on.
Yes, how are you?
Okay, what do you know?
Well, this is a story that we grew up with in the family. When I was a baby, my mother, we were in Miami Beach, and my mother was walking down the street with me in a stroller and carrying a bag of groceries, and this door flew open from a gym and knocked the bag of groceries out of her hand. And this man came out, and she said, well, are you going to help me pick up the groceries? And he said, do you know who I am? And she said, do you know who I am? And somebody else came out and ended up helping her pick up the groceries, but he said, I'm Cassius Clay. And this seems to be contrary to everything we're learning about him and his personality. This was in 62, 63,
yeah,
and before his conversion to Islam. But this story has been told 1,000 times in my family.
Well, I appreciate you sharing it with us. I mean, a young man in a hurry, maybe missing in social graces on that day if the story's right. But everybody's memory of those meetings gets memorialized and carried on. I appreciate that, Linda. Jerry in Morgantown, Kentucky. Jerry, you're on.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to make a comment about Ali. I met Ali 2 times in my life, one time in Louisville and then another time in Bowling Green at the Dr. Martin Luther King dinner.
Mm-hmm.
I have a scrapbook I made of Ali's newspaper clippings, and Ali was kind enough to let me sit down beside him and his wife, Ali, Lonnie, signed the autograph book. They went through it several times. There's pictures in it that she had never seen. He signed at one place where a newspaper clipping of Joe Frazier knocking out Jerry Quarry. He put underneath it, he wrote, to Jerry from Muhammad Ali, 3 times heavyweight champ of the world. I just want to say that Ali was a legend of will and courage that I'm a white man, but I have took a lot of influence, and he has influenced my life greatly.
I so appreciate your call, Jerry. Thank you very much for that. Ishmael Reed, how do you ultimately, no one can deny the courage of this man. What do you tie it back to? Is it something that comes even before his athletic prowess was proved, before his conversion to the Nation of Islam? What was it in the way he came up?
Well, you know, I think that Muhammad Ali was probably a unique personality, probably a person that comes along once in a million, but don't forget the challenges to Sugar Ray Robinson, Joe Louis, Henry Armstrong, and Sonny Liston.
Before Ali.
Actually, they actually engage in physical combat with armed men.
You mean because of race out in the world?
When policemen called Sonny Liston by the N-word, he put him in a trash can. He put the policeman in a trash can. Joe Louis and Sugar Ray Robinson were in a segregated bus station, a white-only bus station. MPs came up, and Joe Louis said, I have as much right to be here as you. I'm a soldier, too. The MP knocked him in the ribs with the nightsticks, and before you know it, Sugar Ray Robinson had wrestled a guy to the ground, and Joe Louis was punching out the other guy, and the fight only ended when somebody said, that's Joe Louis. Joe Louis complained to the White House. Joe Louis did a lot to improve the situation of black soldiers in the segregated army. So, you know, those guys went up against people who were armed. Henry Armstrong, too, he beat up a couple of cops. So I think, you know, we can laud Muhammad Ali, but the generation of fighters who preceded him were not Uncle Toms.
We hear that. Ali took it to another level. 2009, he wrote an essay for the NPR series, This I Believe, and his wife Lonnie read the essay, except for the final words, which Ali read himself. You can hear the Parkinson's in his voice here as he spoke these powerful and familiar words. Muhammad Ali.
I'm still the greatest of all time. This I believe.
Dave Kindred, even when all of that was bearing down on him, so you could still hear the humor and kind of impish intelligence in his voice.
You just used the word that I've often used to describe his personality, impish. He was always up to some mischief, had a twinkle in his eye. The last time I saw him was in probably 2005. I went to the farm in Michigan. He spent, you know, he was not able to speak well then, but he spent an hour drawing me a picture. I'm not sure what the picture was to mean, but he was generous with his time, fed me ice cream, and at one point wanted to take me to his gym, state-of-the-art gym. We walked across there. He had to hold onto my arm, and I had this thought, you know, the greatest athlete I've ever seen now has to hold my elbow to get to his gym. But once in the gym, on the heavy bag, he started hitting the heavy bag. He was, what, 64 years old then, started hitting the heavy bag, and pretty soon you could hear the thumping that he was 25 again. It was a great moment. And he always had that sense of humor. That's why he took me there. He wanted to show me that he was still Ali.
Float like a butterfly, sting like a bee, rumble, young man, rumble. The words of Muhammad Ali, there were many and they moved many. Dave Kindred, really grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks so much for joining us from Carlock, Illinois. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you, Tom.
And Ishmael Reed in Oakland, California, author of The Complete Muhammad Ali. Mr. Reed, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, and thank Dave for that great book he wrote.
Our fondest, most admiring memories of Muhammad Ali. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.